Welcome to this ICMA Women's Network podcast.
I'd like to welcome Allegra Berman, Global Head of Institutional Sales and Global Co-Head of Security Services, Markets and Security Services at HSBC, and who incidentally was recently appointed one of the 100 most influential women in European finance 2020. And with Allegra, I'd like to welcome Wura Olantunbosun, an associate in the Structured Finance Group at Dentons.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Katie. As Katie has already mentioned, you know, our conversation today between myself and Allegra really is focused on intergenerational engagement and connectivity. And I guess just to start off our conversation today, Allegra, I mean, you've had quite an incredible career from your early beginnings at Credit Suisse to Barclays Capital, UBS, and now HSBC. So knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Thanks for the question, Wura, and thanks, Katie, for the introduction, and to ICMA also for the invitation to speak to the Women's Network today. So look, looking back, I've been in the industry for 26 years, and if I look back to when I joined the industry in the mid-90s, it was quite a different time in many, many ways. I think that if I look back to sort of some of the advice that I would have given my younger self, I don't like to think of myself as too old, but my younger self, I think really it's about making sure that you're enjoying what you're doing, and when you're not happy with your setup or your situation or your job or how things are going, to try and recognize that and do something about it yourself quickly. I think too often we find ourselves in a situation where we don't feel fulfilled, we don't feel challenged, where the getting out of bed every day and getting into the office just becomes really a challenge and a chore. And I think that if I'd realized that it was making me unhappy or feeling unwell, you know, I should have done something about it earlier. And I think as a person, I don't always process things as quickly, perhaps, as I should in terms of sort of how I'm feeling about life and my work and my day to day. And I think that it's really about understanding how you're feeling and how you're performing. And if it doesn't feel right, then you need to do something about it, and that one can be, you know, one should be part of the solution. So it's recognizing, you know, those challenges and seeing how you can make the situation better for yourself, because it is in our gift when sometimes we feel it's not, we can actually recognize that and do something about it proactively, rather than letting yourself, you know, in my case, I got sort of quite low and depressed and low energy. And you know, if I sort of thought about why that was happening, I would have changed my situation earlier. So I do think if you feel engaged and motivated, generally, you feel a lot happier about everything in life, you know, at home and at work and in everything that you do. And I think that it is in our gift to fix. And we should be, you know, I would say if there's something that's not right, get to the bottom of why it's not right and think about the possible solutions. And that can be solutions that you find yourself, or you can reach out to friends or colleagues or family to try and get to the bottom of it to fix it. Because as I said, this is often in our gift and we don't necessarily realise we think it's happening to us, but we can respond to it in a faster way.
Absolutely. Allegra, I completely agree with everything you've said. And I think that would definitely resonate with a lot of people listening in, particularly, you know, given the current climate, the state of things as well in the world at the moment. So definitely, you know, I would echo the same sentiments. And in terms of the nature of the challenges now that you've kind of had to face and overcome during the course of your career, would you say it was easier to, I guess, progress within the world of finance as a more credentialed and established woman versus when you started off as a very kind of junior employee? And in your view, have the challenges been different, or, you know, what's your take in that regard?
So I think when you start off, obviously you are the recipient of a lot of instructions. And I think you are at the beck and call, because you have a lot of people around you that are more senior, that need work done, that have to give you direction. And you're a little bit powerless to structure your day when there are certain tasks that you are given to do. So look, does it get easier as you are established and people understand how you work and your contribution and what you bring, and you understand the rhythm of work and how to perform? Look, it definitely does get easier because you're established and people know, you know, they count on you, they know you're going to be dependable, they know you're going to deliver. Whereas when you first start, you really have to prove that, and you have to prove it to a lot of people as you get to, you know, build your network and build your teams and work closely with people around you on whatever kind of product or project that you're working on? I mean, the challenges change, of course. One is about you need to produce things to tight deadlines. They have to be of a certain quality. You know, as you move up the organization, you have different challenges presented in terms of how do you run teams? How do you get people to buy into your team and to want to continue to work for you? How do you attract and retain talent? There are different challenges that you face, but I certainly think that when you start off, it is about, you know, establishing yourself and people getting to know what you bring, because we all bring something, and you've been hired because you bring something and someone has seen some potential and talent in you that they want to foster. And I think you need to understand when you start that you've been brought in because someone has believed that you have potential and talent. So you should feel confident in that, but you still need to show that that decision was the right one and that you do bring something to the firm or to the team that you're in. And I think the industry, you know, obviously it's changed enormously. I mean, the challenges that I faced when I was a junior, which was back in, you know, I joke it was back in the dark ages in the mid 90s, you know, those challenges were different to the challenge that there are today. I mean, it was a much more chauvinistic landscape. The way people behaved was different in terms of if someone hadn't done something well, you know, people would be very vociferous and perhaps across a trading floor in a way that today that would be completely unacceptable. There, as I said, there are different types of challenges. It's much easier to be yourself today and bring your whole self to work and be more open about who you are inside and outside the office. You know, there is that bringing your whole self to work in a way that, again, was more challenging back then. So being a junior in those times was different. And I make no illusion that I don't understand all the challenges, and I'm learning all the time about the challenges that the next generation brings in as they join the organization. But I do think, you know, once you have a track record and you are more established, you know, that does get easier.
It is interesting because, you know, as someone who's relatively junior in my kind of career path as well, I definitely kind of identify with some of the things you've already mentioned in that, you know, you are the recipient of instructions from various people and, you know, you are expected to prove yourself. And as you've mentioned, you know, times have moved on and we do have that opportunity now, I guess, to be our whole selves at work. And it's important that, you know, junior people are taking advantage of that opportunity, have been more confident and speaking up, I guess, and being more visible to the extent that you can. But certainly I do kind of identify with some of the things you've said already. So I'd be kind of interested to understand from your perspective throughout the course of your career, what is the best piece of advice that you think you've ever received?
I think it's hard to put it down to just one bit of advice. I've been blessed and had a lot of good advice given to me over the years. I'll just share two that I think for me have resonated during the course of my career. The first actually comes from my mother, which we said, look, Allegra, if you don't ask, you don't get. And I do think that's right. And in my experience and what I've seen in my time in the city, I would say that it is, and please forgive me for this perhaps generalization, but I find that women in particular don't ask unless they feel 110% confident that they can do the role. And so they are a little bit timid to ask. And also I think they expect, because they work hard and they do well, that someone will come along and say, well, that's brilliant, here's a bigger job. And I think that is, to be frank, I think it's naive in this world, because I think you need to be clear that if you're a strong performer and you can bring something, you know, and you need to feel confident that you can ask for more, even if you can't tick every single box in terms of the skills required for that role, you know, you can highlight all those skills that you have and that are transferable. And I think that you need to be forthright in being demanding for what you would like to do next. It is in our gift. And to make the assumption that someone is just going to give you more because you're sitting there doing a good job, it's extremely unlikely that that happens. So I think I've always been clear, if I've wanted something, I've gone ahead and asked for it. And I'm happy to have the conversation as to why I don't get it or where the gaps are or why not. But I think, again, you need to show that you have the appetite and hunger and ambition for a particular role. So that's the first thing I would say. And then the second point I would make, which was brilliant advice and that I use every day, is don't be afraid by silence. So I think when you want to negotiate, and this could be negotiate for a deal, negotiate your promotion or your compensation or any kind of anything that you need day to day, don't be afraid when you ask that difficult question in the meeting just to be quiet. And I think, again, women, I think, like to make other people feel quite comfortable in the environment. So we'll fill that silence with quite a lot of talk and chatter because they want people to feel comfortable. And silence is tricky. And silence, you know, 10 seconds of silence can feel like minutes, but it's an incredibly powerful tool. So when you're asking for something, particularly when they're tough questions, as I said, it could be a negotiation on a price of a contract, it could be for a promotion, it could be anything really. When you ask that question, don't let that discomfort mean that you fill the void. You want someone to feel uncomfortable because in my experience, 9 times out of 10, they don't want that discomfort, so they give you what you want, or they're more willing to concede or move towards you. So this idea about silence being golden in that regard is something that I've followed and I think has been incredibly powerful for me in all sorts of negotiations through my career. So I would encourage you just to be quiet when you ask that question and let someone step in.
So just kind of going back to some of the things that you've said. So if you don't ask, you don't get. I think in my experience as well, the kind of best piece of advice I've been given totally aligns with this in that, you know, there's a tendency as a woman, as you've mentioned already, and as a minority to feel like you need to justify your presence in certain spaces, which can manifest itself in the form of feeling like you need to be perfect at everything or an expert before you put your hand up for things or before you put yourself forward for things, which is a struggle that I guess men might not necessarily have in a way, because they have that confidence very early on to kind of be vocal about their strengths and what they bring to the table. So certainly in my experience as well, that's something I've heard quite a bit, you know, in terms of putting myself out there. And one thing I found as well is that people are quite generally receptive, especially to younger people at a more junior level, if you demonstrate that, you know, you're teachable, you're hardworking, etc. And a lot of times it's not really that they're looking for a perfect candidate. They're more looking for someone who is open and who will get the job done and who will work hard towards the desired objective. So absolutely, if you don't ask, you don't get. And that is something I'm going to, you know, also keep in mind for myself going forward. So thank you for that, Allegra.
Laura, what would be, so that's the, you just asked me questions and I've given those two pieces of information. I mean, what would you say for you, what's the best advice that, or some of the best advice that you have received?
For me personally, yeah, I think certainly putting myself forward is a key piece of advice that I've received, because again, it kind of stems back to that feeling like, you know, you need to be perfect before you enter into certain situations or before you even speak up or become visible. And having that confidence very early on in your career can be quite useful. And again, you know, confidence is something that you build over time. And the more you do it, the more you speak up, the more you're vocal about certain things, the better you get at it and the better you get at negotiating, because you're kind of getting used to that discomfort, I guess, of speaking up and being seen. So certainly, I think putting myself out there and not being afraid to be visible very early on, even as a junior, if that makes sense. So I wonder, from your perspective, Allegra, what is the best piece of advice you think you've ever given somebody as opposed to received from someone?
I can't take credit for it. I mean, I have recycled what I've received. So those pieces of information around, you know, not being shy to have difficult conversations, and then how to be convincing in those negotiations through the silence, through the listening. I think it's important when I've talked about networking with people, and they've said, well, you know, I'm going to meet this person, you know, what do you think I should say? And it's important that I get on their radar. And I will say, look, before you go into a meeting, there'll be a lot of topics that you will no doubt touch on. But think about when you leave that room, what are the three things that you want that person to remember about you? And have that in your mind completely clearly. You know, you do not want to leave that room until you have made that impression on those two or three, whatever the number is. But two or three key, not more than that, two or three key takeaways. When that person leaves the room, what are the, if someone said, well, how did that go? Or what, really, you met this person, what do you think? Or impressions or any feedback. What are the two or three absolutely key non-negotiable things that you want that person to remember and know about you? And I think having that absolutely clearly in your mind does focus the conversation and means that you get that, you land that better. And I think that, you know, we're all very time pressured. So making sure if you've got that 15 minutes, what are the key points you want to land? I think that's very important to have a framework ready for that conversation.
Absolutely. In my perspective, I would just add to that, and going back to what you said in the beginning about your well-being, etc. I think, again, probably one of the most important things I've said to somebody in terms of advice is to make sure, you know, as a junior, that you're defining your own idea of success as well. And this kind of ties in with what you've already said about your general well-being and whether or not you feel happy doing what you're doing in that particular moment. I think the tendency as well, when we tend to have that conversation around whether or not women can have it all, I think it's important that we as women leave room in that conversation for individual women to define what that idea of having it all is. give to them, because it's an achievement and success is a deeply kind of personal concept. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, what we're all kind of fighting for is the, I guess, freedom to choose what that means for us on an individual level. So absolutely, like, that ties back into general well-being and just making sure that whatever stage you're at, that you're feeling happy and you want to get up in the morning and do what you're doing. So thank you for that. So now, on the point of female role models within the industry, how important do you think it is to have female role models within the finance industry? And in particular, do you think there might be an issue when it comes to the accessibility and relatability of particular role models? Because again, the conversation tends to center around representation of women at that board and management and executive level. But do you think there is that accessibility kind of issue in this regard?
So look, I think it is important to have role models, and that isn't just, you know, female role models for women, but it could be role models, you know, that is there somebody that is a little bit like me that has made it in that organization? And that could be someone who's gay, can be someone who's black, can be a woman, doesn't matter. It can be in all its shapes and sizes. So I do think there is currently a war on for talent and diversity between firms. And in the financial services industry, which no doubt has been historically very undiverse, that war for diversity is becoming a bigger war. And I think that it is now clear that it is also a commercial imperative to have diversity and to have a broad, talented workforce. And I think that for me, it's key. And I get this in a whole host of sessions that I do, you know, internally or across the industry. If people look at a firm, if they can't see someone that represents something that they stand for or that they feel strongly about, or that that means that they can, someone with whom they can identify in some way, that's pretty unattractive, because you think, well, why is that? Why is there nobody like me? Does that mean I can't be my true self in that environment and succeed? And if we want to attract, retain and develop talent, yeah, in this case, you know, female talent, you do need to see people that you think, well, yeah, I want to be like them. I want to aspire not to everything they do, not to be exactly like them, but I don't feel it's going to impede me in a successful career in that organization. So I think in that regard, role models, and I said it's not just about female roles, but role models of any type of role model, can I identify with it? Can I succeed, or am I going to have to hide part of me in order to do so? And I think my generation did do that. I did that. I'm gay, and it would have been unthinkable in the mid-90s. I felt it would have been unthinkable to be out about that. And, you know, already I was the only, you know, almost the only woman on the trading floor. So to have that as well, it would have been really challenging. I don't think that's so much of an issue now. But even the other day, you know, I was asked by a young male colleague to say, look, I've been told that I'm gay and that I'll never be a managing director. And I said, that is nuts. I said, and let me be clear. So it's, you know, it's a duty for me to be very, I feel it's, you know, important that I'm open about it, because I want people to know that this is not an impediment. So there's a duty of kind of care almost. So look, I think role models are important because you need to identify to them in some way. And I think if we want to have the most talented people join our company, we need to make sure that they know that they can thrive as themselves. You know, I know I'm not a role model for everyone, and I wouldn't encourage people to copy another person's style in order to succeed. They have to be able to be true to themselves, but some characteristics they will want to see that they have, that they see in others, that they think, well, yeah, that means I can develop those characteristics. I can develop who I am the way that I want to be and be authentic and grow and succeed in that way. So if we don't have different types of role models in our organizations, then we will only attract one kind of person. And that's not the right way to have different perspectives, find different types of solutions and services, and look after our customers and our colleagues in the right way. So in order for us, you know, we need to have different role models in order to attract different talented people. You know, before you're a managing director, if you're knocking on the door of being a director or an MD, they're the top two levels at my firm. You need to look at that and say, well, is this a place that I can succeed in? Because if I look around me and there's nobody that exhibits characteristics that I have, then that looks less likely to me that I'm in the wrong place. And firms do not want that, because they want to keep the talented people. So they need to have really strong role models.
I absolutely agree at what you've already said, Allegra, especially insofar as, you know, representation and being able to see people who kind of exhibit parts of you within an organization. I know for me in the past, obviously I haven't been doing what I'm doing quite as long as you have, Allegra, but coming out of university, there were moments where I would attend networking events and the decision as to whether or not I applied to a particular firm could be based on something as simple as how I felt conversing with certain people or the nature of the people who showed up from the firm at the networking event. So if I go away from a particular event feeling maybe slightly uncomfortable or that I won't be included or I will not feel represented in a particular firm, but definitely, you know, regardless of whatever perks or additional kind of benefits that they might be providing, I think that for me personally would take priority over anything else. And it would be such a shame as well to miss out on talent and putting in so much effort to give all these extra advantages when really the decision for a lot of people boils down to whether or not they feel comfortable and they feel like they will be represented and visible and included at your organization. So absolutely, it is important to have female role models from that kind of representation point of view and just role models generally. Now, on the point of kind of accessibility when it comes to female representation within the industry, do you think there needs to be more conversation around representation for women, for female role models at all kind of stages within an organization, especially, you know, from the perspective of newer kind of younger women who are coming into such an organization? One thing I've heard from colleagues and friends is that there can often be a disconnect if the only female role model available is at, say, for example, board level or management level, and they're only a year out of university, for example. So do you think there needs to be more done in that space, or is this something that we need to be taking more seriously or talking about a bit more?
Yeah, look, absolutely. So I think that, you know, already now we're working, again, this is very different to when I started out, but, you know, now the intake that into the firm, you know, everyone is striving for 50-50 in terms of a gender split. So what you see is you see 50-50 at the incoming, and now you need to have people at different levels because, you know, you'll have a moment where, you know, if you're wanting to have, for example, a family and you're wanting to have kids and you're there still taking time out, you know, you need to have people that you can talk to that have left to do that, that have come back in to do that. How do you navigate through that? You know, do you have people that have successfully done that without overly compromising the professional or their personal lives? So yeah, it's no good if you've just got women at the board level and female graduates. I mean, it has to go all the way through, and, you know, women will need different things at different times, as will male colleagues. I mean, it's not necessarily gender specific. It is obviously somewhat gender specific in that if women want to go off and actually have babies themselves, they will obviously need to take time out. And I think they need to see a way in and a way out that is supportive. So yeah, you absolutely need to have it throughout the organization. And I think that it's clear that there is a dearth of female talent at that sort of director and perhaps senior sort of associate director, we call it. So a sort of second or third level down within the firm. And we often lose people. And this is the industry as a whole. It's not just my firm. It loses people at that sort of associate director, director level because they can't see a way through. And because the board seems so far away, the firms haven't yet figured out a way of how to get women back into the sales force if they have taken some time out. And I think it's helping navigate through that. Or how do we find something that's more supportive? And the voices around parental leave policy, and how do we get that right? And that is still very much a work in progress. I think we've got a long way to go, but at least it's now being discussed much more actively. And I think people are speaking about what they need in order to, you know, to come back and for it to work. So this point about can you have it all? I think it's hard to have it all at the same time.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people would tend to agree with that, Allegra. I think even to add the perspective of somebody who's a little bit junior in their kind of career course, I think when you go into an organization and the only sort of representation that you have is at a very senior level, whilst that's great, you know, it's a good thing and that we certainly want that. There is something to be said though for the ability to see somebody who's maybe immediately above you and to see how they're navigating challenges and how they are progressing through a particular organization, which in turn can help you almost visualize yourself moving to that particular firm or organization as well. And also when it comes to kind of having honest conversations around the nature of the challenges that you faced as well, it is certainly helpful to have somebody who is a bit more aware or who still remembers what it's like to be forging a new career path. So absolutely, it's important to ensure that, you know, there's female representation at all levels levels, even from the perspective of younger women like myself.
Yeah, look, I think I just to sort of follow on that. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think that when I went to panels years ago, women on those panels would say, yeah, it's just about working harder and working harder than your male colleagues. That is not the answer. That is not the answer, right? It's about productivity. It's about how do you work flexibly? How do you, you know, how do you choose to navigate your career and know that your firm is going to support you through that, because they want you to be at their firm for a long time. They want you to feel motivated and supported and encouraged. And I think that my generation was different. We would sit there and say, yeah, it's just about working harder than boys. You leave your jacket on the back of your chair when you leave in the evening. I mean, that just sounds so archaic.
Yeah, definitely. You tend to hear that a lot. And, you know, as I said already, it helps to have people within an organization who can actually speak quite honestly about their career progression and their progress within an organization and their challenges, which can in turn, you know, almost serve as inspiration for younger women and for them to think about the ways in which they can possibly kind of progress and move through that particular firm as well. So again, in keeping with this theme of intergenerational connectivity and exchange, what in your view do you think is the most important thing that you've learned from your more junior colleagues?
Yeah, well, I knew you were going to ask me the question, and I did joke sort of about how to use LinkedIn and sort of adopting social media in a much more sophisticated way. Look, I think what has been interesting for me is this concept of vulnerability. It's about when I was sort of coming up through the ranks years ago, there was a work Allegra and there was a home Allegra, and they didn't really overlap that much. And there was a persona that I was in the office, and there was a different persona, not a radically different persona, but it was sort of a very private persona that was outside the office. And I didn't really like to blend them. And that really's changed, because that's not how the younger generation view life. They want to be able to be themselves and be authentic and share more and be sort of, when I say vulnerable, it's just be more open about who they are and not fearing that that's going to be held against them or an impediment to their success. And I think that showing that I'm open to sharing more about that, so people get to know you a bit more and your drivers and motivators and who you are, allows more of a speak up culture, allows more feedback sort of up and down and, you know, side to side, which is very, very healthy. So I think that it allows you to bring your sort of whole self to work, because you can be who you are. And I think that my generation and I was not very good at that. And I think I have learned to do that. And what I've learned from that is that by being much more open, it creates much stronger bonds and a sense of trust. And I've really noticed that. So people that work with me and for whom I work and who work for me, I noticed that spirit of being open and sharing. You know, the fact that I'll be on Zoom and my son will come in and say, you know, please can you do my tie for school because he's six, you know, and colleagues see that. I mean, that would be unthinkable, not because we wouldn't have been using Zoom, but, you know, you didn't show that part of you, because it sort of showed that you were a parent, and it showed that you had other parts of your life that would take up time and focus, which back then was not really acceptable. So I have learned that, and I think that has been very beneficial for me, because I said it's about building trust and being open and showing a side of you, perhaps a different side, maybe a softer side, but a different side.
Absolutely. And I think, again, that kind of ties in with even your general well-being as well. If you feel as though you can be your full self, your authentic self, irrespective of whether, you know, you're at work or you're in your house, it is kind of very beneficial for everybody, really, because then we're all kind of able to show up as our best selves, which is quite important, because it means then you're able to be better at work because you're showing up fully. So I, you know, completely agree with that. And so in your view, then, do you really think there's something to be gained from this kind of intergenerational exchange and connectivity? Is it something that needs to be encouraged a bit more within organizations, or what's your take on that?
Yeah, look, I think it does, because I think that, you know, I make no pretenses that I know it all. I think I'm experienced and I've seen, I've got lots of war stories from my time working in different countries and different products and services within the financial services industry. But I do think I'm always keen to learn. And in the same way that when you have a team, you know, different people have different motivating factors of what they want. Some people want to manage large groups of people. Some people want large amount of compensation. Some want the title. Well, everyone has different drivers. And I think that, you know, I've learned that through managing people over many years. But I think that it's so important to know that you can keep learning. And the drivers for you will be somewhat different for the drivers for me. But you will be open about those drivers in a way that perhaps, as I said, people that are higher up now, when they started, they weren't as open and transparent. And it wasn't an easy conversation to have. So I think, again, in the search for talent, for attracting the talented people and for keeping them motivated and helping develop and nurture that talent, we absolutely must listen to and learn from what are the needs and desires from people in our team that are coming into the industry? Because as an industry, we want to be an attractive place to get the talented people to come and work. You know, when we were talking about fintech and the tech boom, applications to banks went down. So banks have to think, well, how do we make this an attractive place to get these sharp minds that are ambitious and hungry and smart to come into our industry? And how do we keep them there? You know, it's not just about the compensation. It's about how do we offer people a really attractive career? And, you know, I've had to learn that if I think about the millennials, it's not, there used to be a time when you'd say, if you join this company, you'll be here for life. I mean, I would have thought, you know, that would ring alarm bells for many people who say, I don't want to be somewhere for life. You know, I don't want to be at one company for the next 30 years. I want to go from project to project. That's what I'm going to look at. You know, will CVs be the same? This amount of GCSEs and these A-levels and this university? Or will it be, I've worked on this project and developed these skills. I've worked on that project and developed these skills. You know, it will be different. The profile is different. And I think that there's so much to be learned for how we want to take it forward. I also think the idea of boundary setting, you know, now COVID has somewhat changed that. We might talk about that a bit later, but you know, I want a balance in my life. You know, I want to get, I want purpose to my life, which is above and beyond just my desk job. I want to feel that it serves a higher good, if you like. That's something that, you know, I think we were cavalier about it years ago, particularly in financial services. And we've had to recognize that and think long and hard about how we make a difference to the community and to customers and to our colleagues and to our lives.
And do you think as a way of kind of, I guess, fostering this intergenerational exchange of ideas and even engendering cultural shifts to a certain extent, do you think reverse mentoring could be a useful tool for doing this, for this kind of exchange of ideas between the generations?
So look, I think reverse mentoring is great, but I do think it is not the answer to all our prayers. And I say this because banking and a lot of our clients, it is hierarchical. And it is hard to reverse mentor when you're doing that to someone who frankly is going to be paying and promoting you or people around you. So I think it serves a purpose in terms of creating an environment where someone can speak up. And I think that's good. But I think one should be realistic about the fact that it can only go so far, because I think it's good to hear about what are the, you know, what are the frustrations, what are the attractions, to feed back on that experience and that career journey. But equally, you know, these are hierarchical organizations. And with that, as I said, you know, if you're reverse mentoring, that can be really challenging when those people are going to be involved in actually very concretely around your direct career. It means how honest sometimes can that conversation be, or how constructive can that conversation be? So I'm not saying it shouldn't happen. Clearly it should. I think it is healthy. And I do think we see a much better speak up culture today. It can still get better, and it's not consistent across the globe, because culturally in different countries, you absolutely don't speak up to people that are more senior than you. So I do think it's helpful. You know, and I myself say to my boss, you know, how do you want me to communicate with you? How would you like me to give you feedback? And when I say that to my boss, they look absolutely horrified, because they're not used to it. And then when I say, well, I think this was great, but by the way, I think this could have been better if you'd handled it like that, actually 9 times out of 10 they're really grateful, because everyone always gives them the positive feedback. But to have something that's constructive, that perhaps isn't quite as rosy, means that they too can learn. That does create bonds of trust and an openness to listening to that when it's given. I also think it's good for the younger talent to be able to know how to give that feedback robustly, but in a way that lands well, which is something also that we spend a lot of time trying to learn, how we make those messages land in the right way. How do you find it? Have you done a lot of reverse mentoring?
Not a lot, but I've certainly been involved in schemes that are aimed at, I guess, educating people who are more senior within the organization about the issues that are being experienced by other people within the firm. And then I thought really the success or failure of such an idea really depends on how receptive and how open people are to such ideas. I find that sometimes maybe the older generation can be a little bit more rigid in their approach to things, and they can be a little bit slower to accept feedback, especially when it's coming from their more junior colleagues. But again, as I said, the success of it really depends on how open people are going in, and, you know, really understanding that this is a two-way process and there is something to be gained by everybody at the end of it. From my perspective, you gain an insight into management and the business in a way that you ordinarily might not have an exposure to, being so far down in the chain of command, I suppose. And then from their perspective, it kind of can encourage a shift in cultural thinking within the firm, and they better understand the people that they're employing, and they can kind of better understand how to retain people. Even if you look at it from the perspective of staff retention and attrition rates, if you understand what attracts people and how to keep them there, they're going to stay with you for a longer time, because, you know, they see that you're actively taking an interest in them. And again, kind of going back to, I guess, my generation of the workforce, as you've mentioned, longer the days where you finish university and you go into a particular role for 30 odd years and that's it. Nowadays, we're very much focused on, you know, well-being well-being and job satisfaction, and you want to be happy doing what you're doing, which might not have necessarily featured prominently previously, but now increasingly people want to feel like they're making meaningful contribution, they're being seen and being heard. So certainly reverse mentoring can act as a useful tool, you know, as a means of kind of encouraging this sort of connection and conversation between the generations. But again, everybody has to be open and receptive for it to work. In your view then, just kind of moving on, what do you regard as the most significant cultural shift in working culture throughout the course of your career?
What do I think has changed so much in that? Look, I think we have a much, you know, the speed of change in our industry has gone through incredible transformation, right? And working through COVID has accelerated certain changes on the tech front for how we work. And the fact that we're doing this session now over Zoom with a large audience participating through, you know, screens and mobiles. So the connectivity, how people are connected, you know, we've got a global, in the company I work at, we're across a very large number of countries, you know, almost 250,000 people in employment. So connectivity and how fast you can connect through whatever medium you can get your hands on, that's really changed the culture, really. So that speed to reply and how fast we have to connect and how we collaborate to get global solutions for global clients, that's really changed in our culture. So sort of this tech-enabled culture, you know, we're going to be technology-led very much so. That's not to take away from the human factor, but you know, technology is playing a massive part in how our culture is developing. You know, I think that what have we seen? We've seen a much greater awareness around ESG. And this is partly, you know, driven again by millennial Generation Z. So the culture about being much more aware of our impact on society and communities, you know, how we're trying to embrace and embed ESG concepts in everything that we do and how we live. You know, this is, can be from recycling in your own home through how do I find financial solutions for clients that are going to be, have a positive ESG or not a negative ESG impact in what we do. And I think that because we operate much more globally, much faster, we've all learned to be much more culturally sensitive, you know, and much more culturally appreciative, I think. You know, this is about understanding other cultures, understanding other mindsets, being sensitive to those people that are from groups that are perhaps not well represented or not fairly represented in terms of even just basic statistics, you know, in terms of having, we're underrepresented in certain areas. So again, that diversity in a global workforce, that appreciation, understanding and trying to address faster, that we can always do a better job at it, but being much more aware and being proactive around it. So I think, you know, those cultural shifts, but it, you know, it's just the pace of change has been so rapid, and COVID is another foot on the accelerator to how we need to develop our businesses and our workforce and how we operate day to day. So, you know, and I think the speak up culture has obviously changed. I think the ideas of reverse mentoring again, 10 years ago, I mean, 5 years ago, pretty unthinkable in financial services and other sectors that would have been embraced. But this is still really new for us.
Absolutely. And just kind of keeping in line with COVID then, because I don't think we could have engaged in this conversation today without mentioning the pandemic. Obviously, it has brought on a lot of hardships for many people, and the financial industry is no exception to this. How, in your view, do you think the finance industry has adapted to the challenges brought on by the pandemic? Has it adapted at all, in your view, or is it still a little bit stuck in the past?
Well, look, I mean, there's definitely been a sea change, right? I mean, there's no doubt about that. And I think that obviously what's changed is that everyone's, I think, focus and budgets towards tech have obviously changed. And I think the way that we've embraced that, had to embrace it, but now embedded it, has been brilliant. And I don't see us going back on that. I think everyone that had a budget for tech that they thought they'd spend over the next 5 years, they've no doubt spent that in the first 5 or 6 months if they could. And that will continue, as I said, as we are a tech-led industry. And I think those that want to survive and prosper will continue to invest disproportionately in technology and connectivity through tech. So that is going to continue. And I think that, you know, a lot of people have embraced that. You know, it's allowed flexibility for many people, and it's given people greater mobility because they haven't had to physically be mobile, but they've been able to work on a whole host of things that they might not have been able to do had they been a physical requirement to be in different places at different times. Having said that, there are some aspects to it that have been less good. So for those that have had, we've all been working remotely. So in the initial period of lockdown, when everybody was working remotely and not in an office environment, I think that was fine because we were all on the same footing. I think what's becoming a challenge now is the hybrid model between those that are going into the office and those that are not, because how do you hear those voices and how do those people that are still working remotely, how do they network? You know, how do they get their voices heard in the same way if you're not in the room? Now, you may be in a socially distanced room, but you're in the room. You know, how is that going to unfold going forward as we go back to this sometimes in the office, sometimes not, rotating in and out through different, if you'd have a team A and a team B, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, that is difficult. And I also think there's the mental health challenge for a lot of people who are working perhaps on their own, at home, who really miss interaction with others. Even if you're in a room and there's only three of you in a room for 20, you know, you still miss that human touch. So I think that is a real challenge that we'll need to try and address going forward. Look, I think I did an exercise with my team the other day, you know, what's the good, the bad, the keep and the change of COVID? And obviously COVID has had a devastating effect on many, many people. But in a work context, what I mean by that is, how have we adapted in a way that really is tremendously efficient and allowed us to do more and be much more productive? And so what would we keep? And then what are those aspects actually that have been really challenging? Like, how do we keep colleagues that are on their own in a small flat or multi-generational living? In some countries, you know, we've got 3 or 4 generations in a relatively small flat because the culture is that you live multi-generationally. You know, how are they going to do that? How are people going to do it when they've got to homeschool children if schools go into lockdown again and work? And the blurring of the boundaries. Now, initially, when we were working from home, I think people quite liked the idea of working from home. They didn't have to commute. They could have breakfast with their partners or flatmates or kids. That was great. You know, you didn't have to worry about the trains being delayed or flights being cancelled or all these different things. But now, actually, I think those lines have blurred somewhat. And I don't know about how you feel, Wira, but I do think that commuting time actually was a little bit of downtime in some ways. You know, it was time to read a book, listen to a podcast, read the paper, magazine, whatever it was that allowed you to switch off for a little. And now I think it is blurring again into when are you on, when are you off? And that isn't positive. Technology means that we're always on. I mean, when I started, there weren't even mobiles, let alone the internet. So, you know, that means that boundaries, it is harder to keep those boundaries. And I worry about that from a mental health perspective, because we want people to bring their best to work and take their best home, you know. And I think that is hard when these lines are blurred and getting that work-life balance, being able to switch off, you know, properly, to spend quality time doing whatever you want to do that isn't attached to work. As I said, whether that's time with friends or families or hobbies or sports or whatever, is really difficult. So I think it is, we will need to go through a period of what works, what allows us to be the most productive in the healthiest way possible, healthy physically, mentally, so that we can continue to get the best out of ourselves and our performance in what we do, whether that's, as I said, at work or at home. So I think we're still figuring that one out. But I do think that blurring of the line, that has, I think, noticeably deteriorated in the last sort of 2 or 3 months, I would say. So that needs to be worked through. But I mean, we all know this isn't going away. And the challenge is that, you know, everyone says there's light at the end of the tunnel. Just no one knows how long the tunnel is.
Yeah, and just to add to what you've just said, Allegra, I mean, it is great to see how the industry has adapted quite well, I guess, from a technology kind of perspective, in that, you know, we've really, I guess, embraced the technology because we've had no choice but to do so. I mean, a number of years ago, I recall, for law firms anyway, and I'm sure you can draw parallels and comparisons with the finance industry as a whole, you know, firms were quite literally having consultations upon consultation as to whether remote working was feasible. Then is this what we should be doing? And then now all of a sudden, this is something we've had to adapt to and adjust to overnight. So it's great that the industry's kind of shifted in that sense. And as you've mentioned, mental health seems to be a big thing at the moment that firms and organizations need to be kind of cognizant of. I think, again, the blurring of the work kind of home divide, in addition to just generally the ongoing events in the world at the moment, I think it's very important for firms to be cognizant of the effects of COVID in exacerbating kind of existing inequalities, and just giving the nature of the world as a whole, just to make sure that employees are adequately supported so that, again, they can show up as their best selves, and, you know, which in turn benefits the industry as a whole and society as well. And just to kind of wrap up, Allegra, as a final question to you, what advice would you give to younger women like myself who are seeking to maintain their visibility and their voices and kind of the same level of career aspiration in an environment where we've all to a large extent had to shift to remote working? How would you encourage women in my position to maintain their visibility and their voices?
Look, I think it's hard. I really do. We're all dealing with this is a very new environment. It's unfamiliar to many. And I think it's a real challenge when you're working remotely to maintain that visibility. So we have to be really disciplined around how we do it. And for me, I think what's very important, and I give this advice actually whether one's remote working or not, but it's particularly poignant about in the context of remote working, is you have to get your stakeholder mapping right. So I think that, you know, one talks of, when I talk about networks, if I say there are sort of three networks, really, there's your personal network, your friends, family, support. You have your professional network, day to day, you know, in the office, but you also have a strategic network. You know, who are people that you should try and connect with that you could learn from, that could help you, that could sponsor you, that you can find a hook, you know, to connect with them. And I think that you have to, you know, I stakeholder map. You know, I literally have old-fashioned piece of paper and I stakeholder map. You know, who is it that I should be connecting with, and why would I connect with them, and, you know, where do I think I've got a gap where I think that could be useful for me to get guidance and learn, or could help me doing my job. And you need to find a reason to connect with people. And if you've got a sponsor or a mentor or a peer who knows somebody that you think could be helpful for you, then you need to say, look, can you introduce me? And don't be shy to do so. I think be efficient, you know, just get 10 to 15 minutes of a Zoom coffee. That's fine. It really doesn't have to be very long. And I think if you keep it short and punchy, and again, you think about the three takeaways that you want that person to have when you finish that call, you know, you can be very disciplined and quite concise with it. But I do think you have to focus on that, and you need to force yourself to do it, even if it may seem a bit artificial. Just think of a reason why you can reach out to someone, and you should do so very proactively. And if you set yourself the goal, I think, if I'm going to do three of these a week or three of them a month, whatever it, or one a week, whatever it is that works, but you do need to do it strategically. And I think that that's unbelievably important, because it is very easy otherwise just to get a bit lost in the ether of working remotely. So I think that kind of old-fashioned networking is really important, and we just have to do it through a different medium now.
Absolutely. I would kind of add to that, it just to make sure that people are speaking up at meetings and getting your voices heard in whatever way you can. And again, from a firm's perspective as well, ensuring that they're supporting employees to remain motivated, especially during this time. I think that's all we've got time for today, Allegra. Thank you so much. That conversation has been quite insightful, I know, for me on a personal level. And I hope everyone who's been listening feels the same way.
Just remains for me to say thank you both so much for taking your time out today.
We hope you enjoyed this ICMA Women's Network podcast. For more information about the network, check the ICMA website or follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter.